Hi, everyone. Kel Weinhold from The Professor is in, and we don't need to tell you that these are challenging times. And we have found with the people that we work with that one of the best supports and salves for all of the pain going on right now is community. So we want to invite you to come over and join us on the Himalaya app in our premium community. That's a place you can ask us questions, get to listen to members-only podcasts, access to our Facebook Lives of years gone by, and also of webinars. So we'd really love to have you come over there and join us. We've lowered the monthly price in recognition of all of the challenges that people are facing right now. And we invite you to come along.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Karen Kelski of The Professor is In.
And I am Kel Weinhold, also of The Professor is In. Isn't that odd?
Yeah. Who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
And as always, we are very glad to have you here with us today. So as we told you in the last episode, we are actually revisiting our basic advice, starting with the book and working our way through the book to rethink some of the gaps in our advice in light of the movement for Black Lives. How did the advice that I give in the book reinforce the kind of overwhelming whiteness of the academy or not question it or not complicate it or just not talk about it? Also, there's all sorts of ways it could be engaged with, but the book didn't do any of them.
So, not entirely.
Well, I mean, it made a few efforts, but the point of our next arc in the podcast is to just go chapter by chapter and, talk about what else we could say that would really reflect as well as we are able to, obviously being two white people, but having really taken to heart the many critiques and conversations about racism in the academy and attending very closely to the hashtag Black and the Ivory and the many, many writings and guest postings on the blog itself by Black guest authors, taking those really to heart, that we will do the best we can to try and complicate the advice and make it more representative for the full range of experience.
And I think this next section of the book, the tenure track job search process explained, I mean, on its face, you explained the job search process.
Right.
I mean, you just really said, this is what they do, this is what they do,
right.
This is what they do, this is what they do,
yeah,
which is all true.
Uh-huh.
I think what you didn't do is say, and this is how those things are reinforce the whiteness of the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Don't welcome or engage diverse mm-hmm. voices, are driven by capitalism. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So there was really, I mean, I totally understand what you were doing. You were trying to let people know, hey, this is how it goes.
Yeah. And I chose this kind of, I used the passive voice on purpose to kind of make this like a line is born, an ad is written, a review is conducted,
right?
As if it was sort of these, you know, universal practices, but tongue in cheek, of course, because there are no real universal practices in the academy because everything is contested. But also, I mean,
that kind of
disguises. I mean, in some ways, well, I'm getting myself tangled up here, but you know, I did want to have that sense of the finality of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
an ad is written because yep. it does feel like that in the search, and by digging deeper into that, we can talk about how these unquestioned practices, these absolutely predictable processes that people do not second guess at all, are totally embedded in the overwhelming whiteness of the academy.
Right. And beginning with, you know, a line is created.
Exactly.
The fact that, first of all, I guess what I would say is overwhelmingly, there are not a lot of lines out there being created. So
right.
we have to just look at, I mean, I was thinking as you were announcing that we were going through the book and really looking at this around issues of race, around issues of anti-Blackness, that complicating that even is this the search process
mm-hmm.
within the land of COVID, because
mm-hmm.
it's this little section that you wrote, this mm-hmm. not very many page section that you wrote, mm-hmm. could balloon into this incredibly complicated thing. Because if we're going back, a line is created. Oh, sure. Like, are lines created anymore, or are people just were there four and three of them got eliminated? And it's like a line is coveted, or a line is snatched from the jaws of death or
of oblivion. Yeah, no, that's true. That's absolutely true. And also, it just did occur to me that not everybody is sitting listening to us with a copy of my book open in front of them to follow along. So perhaps it might be polite to articulate that when the chapter four is what we're talking about. And when I say that it's called the Tenure Track Job Search Process Explained. And so let me just, while we talk about each section, let me just explain that what my point was when I wrote the chapter is, this is what is, you're a job seeker. You see a job ad advertised and you apply to it, but the whole thing is a giant black box. I know that.
Right.
For the applicant. And so I wanted to say, hey, search committee members, speaking as a former search committee member, this is what it looked like. We had to first get a line approved.
Right.
And that was section one, a line is born. Then after it got approved at the deans and departments level, then there would be a committee and it would write the ad. That's the section and ad is written. And then after the department approved that ad, it was sent out, and at the deadline, all the applications came in. We reviewed them, and that's what we called a review is conducted. And then we reached a consensus on a short list of like three people for campus visits and two alternates, and that's the section. A short list is finalized. Then the campus visits take place. Oop! I switched out of the passive voice. The editor should have caught that. Anyway, and then I go back to the passive voice. A decision is made, and. And so, yeah, just trying to relieve the black box feeling mm-hmm. of the job search for you, our listeners who may be on the job market.
Right.
And that's a good thing to do. But now we're actually going to
right. And I want to get back to that a line is created.
Mm-hmm.
That number one, I mean, you and I already talked about it, about really getting people to think about, and those of you in the academy to think about, who chooses what line is created? Where mm-hmm. does the money go? How does mm-hmm. someone decide, we're going to create five new lines in mm-hmm. this particular STEM field because it's a money generating field, and we're not going to create this one line in English because of X. And when we do that English line, we're going to do, right. Or
which is, because you're getting warm bodies into seats for the required gen ed writing class and not for, some specialized.
Right. African-American literature. Right.
Because that's going to be, because everybody's eye is on the bottom line
uh-huh.
of maximum uh-huh. butts and seats. So that's appealing to the maximum amount of white people, basically.
Right. But in addition to that, I do want to say that I think it's even not understand or not making it clear to people that what you make clear in your work all the time, which is the system is collapsing, the job market is collapsing, there mm-hmm. haven't been jobs. So even a line is created mm-hmm. is actually hopeful
right.
when a line is actually someone has left.
Lines could be created for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for us to try and toggle delicately between COVID and pre-COVID or COVID and non-COVID,
right.
because I think there is value in understanding how these systems did work.
Yes, yes,
up
yes,
until
yes,
COVID
yeah.
hit
yeah, yeah.
us.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so
yeah.
And so I don't want to throw the entire baby out with the bathwater. Also I did see on Twitter, someone said, hey, called out in the void, is anybody going to be searching next year? And someone responded and said, yeah, we're authorized to search for two positions next year.
Yeah.
So there will be a handful of searches that go forward, even in this hiring freeze scenario.
As departments were shrinking all over, I mean, we saw economics, we saw communications, we saw all of those fields expanding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was in communications at the University of Oregon, the year I left, I mean, in the 2 years, there were 16 new hires.
Yeah, communications was, I mean, again, always with the caveat, we don't know what COVID means for everything, but communications has been extremely strong.
Right.
And
right.
Economics has been
so
strong.
So let's just say that economics and communications are still really strong and a line is created.
Yeah. And so just making clear, a line is created, it would happen because, for example, in anthropology, let's say, you know, Illinois prided itself on its East Asian program. And so it always kept, you know, East Asian anthropologists. And it turned out that for whatever set of reasons, we had a China anthropologist and a Japan anthropologist, but lo, we did not have a Korea anthropologist. So somebody finally made the argument to the department and dean that we needed that because it was an important field and would draw students to us. And somebody believed them. Mm-hmm. And approve that line. That could be an expansion line.
Right.
Alternatively, the China anthropologist could have retired or taken a job somewhere else.
Right.
And then it's like, we have to replace the China anthropologist. And then that's an easier sell. And then that would get approved.
Right.
But the point, larger point is for our purposes today, that what is considered an arguable
line,
the gap that urgently needs to be filled, in terms of the content, we're not talking now about affirmative action or the hiring point itself, where we're shortlisting
about the
and choosing
of
people.
The job.
We're talking, the intellectual project of what does a department need to be a leading department according to the mission and vision that we have laid out collectively for amongst ourselves, the faculty members, and in that light, the intellectual project. Rarely does that ever deviate from what white people have authorized as legitimate knowledge and a legitimate epistemological project.
Well, and I guess what I would say, I mean, I'm saying the same thing, is that if I think about all the hires that I saw and all the hires that I've read with all the different people that I'm working with, the economics of the university, which is follow the money, mm-hmm. If you're going to create a new position in anthropology, in communications, in German studies, in economics, in whatever, and you read those job ads, what's really important is that you can teach the big, you know, that you can come in with one of the, there are multiple classes offered in this area,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So we want you to be able to cover all those multiple things. What I don't believe, which I think is sort of white supremacy personified, or that's probably the wrong phrase, but basically, if I see you and you do 20th century literature,
mm-hmm.
and it just says 20th century literature,
yeah, I see
right?
Where you're going. Yeah.
20th century literature in the Americas, mm-hmm. British 20th century literature, mm-hmm. that person is going to be assumed to be able to teach A, B, C, D,
all those white authors.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You come in and say, I do African-American literature from mm-hmm. this period to this period.
Right.
Immediately, the question is going to be, but can you teach
right.
the canon?
Right, exactly.
As if those people did not get trained in the canon
right.
before they did the specialist study.
Right.
Right. So you wouldn't have been questioned about whether you could teach intro to anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody sees, you know, the anthropology of Asia is so close to whiteness. I mean, in the land of the hierarchy of the closer you get to whiteness,
mm-hmm.
closer than black is,
mm-hmm.
there's more of an assumption that, of course, you can teach Anthro 101 and you can teach this and you can teach that.
Well, I think the larger issue is that I'm white.
Well, yeah.
I would say that it's not a question of the fact that I do Japan. Although, I mean, I see what you're saying. That there are, I mean, to tell you the truth, Japan and East Asia is not one of the really long-standing authorized regions in cultural anthropology. It's a latecomer.
Uh-huh.
And Japan is so highly modernized that it really isn't always viewed as legitimate anthropology the way that Melanesia is.
Right.
And, you know, and Africa and the places that where you know, the tradition of anthropology came from. So yeah, in fact, yeah, I mean, I had a problem even in my own career of being a Japan anthropologist and not being viewed as legit by Africanists, but whatever. But that's a digression. But the point being is that if I did get through, if they were willing to advertise for a Japan anthropologist and I came through the door, then I was going to enjoy all the privileges of whiteness, which is that white people are assumed to be able to study every damn thing we want and to be viewed as an expert on that thing.
Right.
But when a person of color comes into the academy and studies something that's like, let's say a Japanese American is studying African anthropology, all of a sudden, all of these questions, it's like those memes with all those white people blinking and.
Well, and I was thinking actually on the flip side of like, I'll just flip over to communications for a little bit and go into newspapers, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you worked in a newspaper, when I used to work in newspapers, if you worked in a newspaper and you were covering the Black community, there was the core assumption that it would be covered better by a white person because there wouldn't be a bias, because you would be able to cover it more objectively.
Mm-hmm. And but it didn't work the other way, did it?
Never.
How interesting is that?
But what I'm thinking about then is it in the sort of creation of the lines is if we hire this kind of person, they're not going to be able to do these kinds of things, right? So Black reporters were screwed going every direction because it was like, you can't cover this because you don't know, and you can't cover that because you'll be biased.
And you can't cover Black people.
Right. Yeah. So I wonder why you leave.
Yeah.
Gosh, I wonder why the newsroom is, you know, still as white as when I used to be there, so or very close. So anyway,
we've digressed a little bit because in a way we got a little bit off the intellectual project of how what the department and dean considers to be a valid.
Well, not really, because what I'm saying is that in the creation of the line, that if you're looking at economics and you're looking at who can teach everything, because you make the assumption that if we hire an African-American literature person, that's going to limit us economically on what they can teach. That even in the creation of the line, there's this like, well, we better have this broad canon thing.
Right.
So that's what I'm talking about.
In other words, I think you're saying it's a harder sell to get the African-American literature than it is to get Shakespeare, because it's literally unthinkable. That there is an English department anywhere, a major English, a large English department anywhere in the country that does not have at least one Shakespeare specialist.
Right.
You cannot function without it.
Right.
And yet you can totally function without an African-American literature person, according to the logic of whiteness.
Right, right. So I think the line is created is like the very beginning of it, of this assumption like, well, this is kind of like an additional ethnic studies kind of thing.
Right, so let's dig into that. It's super interesting that in America in 2020 at a major research institution that I think, so I'm actually finding it interesting to do this little, have this conversation with you right now, and I'm hitting up against my own assumptions that it is super interesting that we consider Shakespeare how many, 500 years ago?
I don't know.
500 years ago, 400 years before, over 400 years ago, more urgent, more critical, more essential to the education of our young people.
And the understanding of literature.
And the understanding of literature. And everything good and fine and great about the human condition, that we consider him absolutely and simply unquestionably more vital than we do the writing of the literal Black people in the literal country we live in.
Right.
Over the last, frankly, 400 years.
Right.
So it's the exact same time frame, and yet one is valorized utterly.
Right. And I
and one is marginalized utterly.
I just want to push a little bit at your use of the word interesting, that I find often that we as white people say, isn't it interesting?
Yeah.
And the rest of the world is going, it's not fucking interesting. It's ridiculous.
It's painful.
It's your bullshit.
It's outrageous.
I wish I had a stick.
Did I just say that?
Yes, I find it interesting.
Yeah, that drives me nuts. When I listen to white people do that interesting thing, and wow, it's quite fascinating how...
This is where we get to go. Yeah, we white people, we do this shit. Okay, we'll just move on to.
So we were afraid that this would not fill up an entire podcast episode, and we have barely covered. This is, I wish you guys could see the page. We have covered basically
a third of a page
of a five page.
It's only five it's pages only five long. Pages,
but we're going to be talking for 4 hours.
No, we don't have that long. But
no, I know.
But I do want to go to the ad is written,
which is really a continuation, but simply at the departmental level rather than the college or university level, of the same logic we've just been talking about.
What you didn't, what I don't know if you put in here because I didn't read it. I haven't read it. I didn't read this bullshit. I haven't read it in a few years. All right. This book is old. So you have this thing about the ads going out, right? They're going to do a final ad and it's going to be submitted to disciplinary newsletters and the Chronicle of Higher Ed and other things like that. So one of the things that I think is that I think we have to pay attention to is that.
Yes.
This is, I remember when we ran searches for things and there would be this discussion of where can we make sure, you know, affirmative action and everything else says we need to advertise it to diverse places. So where are some of the places that we could reach, potentially get diverse respondents? And that they were always, once again, it was like the ethnic studies class, right? It was always the add-on.
It was the add-on, right? Of course. I remember the same thing.
You didn't spend the tens of thousands of dollars to get it into 10 different, you know, organizations or whatever that are specifically aimed at faculty of color.
Yes.
Instead, it was, okay, we're going to do the Chronicle of Higher Ed, and we're going to do whatever the other one is that I've just forgotten, the Inside Higher Ed. And then we're going to do this communication with whatever the giant communication one is that I've just forgotten. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then we better do, you know.
Oh, and the area study. If there was an area or geographical focus, we'd put it in there.
Right.
And then, oh gosh, I guess we have to do that women's organization. We have to do that, you know, Black historians.
Right.
Or Black communication scholars, or, you know, we would sort of ground around unwillingly to look for them. I mean, in truth, that's how it went.
And
I mean, I wouldn't say unwillingly is not fair. Certainly, I when I was chair of search committee, it wasn't unwilling, but it was absolutely what you're saying. It was like an add-on.
And what I think is important to be challenged there for those of you who are in universities and doing search committees is make the commitment to know the organizations as quickly, to be able to snap them off in to everyone as you can, you know, the Chronicle and Inside Higher Ed and whatever your discipline version is, that you should be able to, in your discipline, be able to say, oh yeah, I know we need to be here, 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 and here.
And there may be some informal networks as well.
Right.
And if you're white, I mean, you're not necessarily going to be included or knowledgeable of the informal networks, but we would hope that you would know somebody who was.
Well, and I would hope that once you knew somebody, you would know about them.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you actually pay attention.
Pay attention, but don't like direct, you know, push your white self into the, you know, middle of
saying,
something.
I'm not and saying join the listserv for, well, you know, whatever.
You know how
the listserv still exists.
You know how white people are.
Yes.
You know how we
are.
It's like we discover something. It's like us trying to solve 400 years of racism in a month. Yeah. You know, it's like, now I need to be in this listserv.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I don't know if listserv still exists. So that was the main thing I wanted to say about the second section is that this ad gets written. The ads, you know, I would love to hear from people about how they read ads as particularly inviting or not inviting or racialized in a way that I wouldn't recognize it. I suppose if I had 10 ads in front of me, I could parse them out. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure there are ways that the ads are more accessible to white audiences because they're typically written. Or just like we were just talking about, but I'm very concerned about where things get advertised, and how they get presented.
Absolutely,
and that in the ad also can be the list of priorities that you want in the position, right? And if you don't list those priorities, so people think, oh well, what the work I'm doing is actually invited and welcome here.
Right.
That's an automatic signal.
And you know, I mean, we do. We are skimming right over because in a way it's not to get into in content is not the point of today's episode, not the point of this chapter, but the degree to which the study of race is still contested. at all in so many of our mainstream fields, like English or well, I'm trying to think of different economics.
Right.
You know, some of the really hidebound fields where it's like, well, this person's, you know, we don't want to put the study of race as one of our, you know, three or four areas of focus, because that's just, you know, well, that's just a tiny little niche and that's just irrelevant. I mean, that's so common. Even, I mean, we're still fighting these battles.
Well, yes, my love, we are. Okay. but I think it goes back to what we were just talking about before. There are things that are centered and they're considered to be the thing you study. Mm-hmm. And then there's that thing, that add on. And so if you're listing that you want to hire somebody and you're not specifically saying that you're interested in these kinds of things, then you're not saying we want a diverse thought. We want different opinions. We want different perspectives. So the ad does get written to reinforce
it. And I mean, I'm just thinking of that story that came out 2 weeks ago of the Yale astronomy or astrophysics department. I guess it's astronomy would be the department. And these old, like ancient white men said, we don't have a racism problem. There is no racism problem. They've literally never had a black faculty member. But the point being that if I'm remembering the story right, so, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners. But what I do know for a fact is that the ancient white man said, well, Gloria, and again, I think the name might be wrong here, but
this is a great story. This might not be true, and this might not be true, and this might not be true, but let me tell you this story.
But the gist is true.
Okay, what's the gist?
That this ancient white man anthropologist astronomer said that Yale astronomy does not have a problem with racism because Gloria worked for us and she never complained. And Gloria was the administrative assistant,
right?
And she worked there and retired in like 1995.
Well, I mean, it's like,
and that he literally said that.
Yeah, it's like that whole Bethel, Ohio thing of, you know,
we never had racism till those Black Lives Matter people came to town.
Well, till the white people brought it up. I mean, they were white people doing the Black Lives Matter thing, but they didn't have a racism problem until those people brought it up.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because everybody's white here. Okay.
So there was one other thing I wanted to say about the ad being written and shaking the bushes to get the widest possible diversity of applicants is that informal networks are really important. And that if you don't mobilize the informal networks for faculty of color, then you are de facto mobilizing the informal networks for white trainees. Because basically, even though the way that our job market is very, very regimented and actually quite transparent nowadays compared to what it was in the 50s and the 60s, when it really was a phone call economy, where Yale guy called Harvard guy and says, "Who do you have a guy for me?" And he says, "Why, yes, I do." And that guy came down and that's how Yale hired. That's not the way it works anymore. And it really, you know, there is a lot more opportunity now on paper, but the opportunity has to be made available and people have to be informed.
Right. Right. You have to know what's happening.
And then what's written on the paper, as we just said, has to be, laying out the welcome.
Right. Now the next step in this section is a review is conducted,
and that's where the whole thing happens.
Right,
that's where the big racism happens.
Oh, do you think that's there, or do you think it's at the campus visit?
Oh yeah, you're right. It's what a good question.
Because I think that you can.
You're right.
You can hide a lot in your application. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean that people would choose to hide it. I mean that it may not be apparent to some readers that of the applications that you're going to show up and be who you are.
And
right?
See, I'm going to take a slightly different perspective on that. I'm going to say it might be completely apparent who you are, as well it should. And the search committee will say, "Ooh, we're interested in that person."
Yeah.
On paper. And then the person shows up.
Right. But let's look at a review is conducted, because I think that a ton happens right here I don't like this implicit bias, because I don't think it's implicit. I think it's straight up bias that happens in here. And when people start reviewing applications, I think that bias happens based on where the PhD came from.
Oh my gosh. Yes. And where the undergrad is from.
Where the undergrad
is
from.
And that's a real litmus test of class and economic background.
Right.
Absolutely.
So there's a prioritizing, right?
There, right? Your Ivy League undergrad or your elite liberal arts college, your Northeastern elite liberal arts college, you know, there's going to be a preference for that pedigree.
Right, which is not an automatic assumption of whiteness,
but pretty
it increases the percentage chance, yeah, of whiteness over a large,
absolutely,
state institution or an HBCU.
Mm-hmm.
So, or
regional teaching colleges, where so many people who come from a lower socioeconomic status, if they get to get a BA at all, they get it from a regional teaching college.
Right.
A lot of kids I went to high school with did that.
Right. I mean, and there's an increasing number of, you know, minority serving institutions that we see increasing diversity out of great, you know, great complex content degrees. And those are still, you know, state colleges, mid-range colleges, all those things. And they are not the right. Harvards and the Yales, right, and the whatever. So I think, first of all, there's the obsession with pedigree.
Yes.
So pedigree automatically narrows down the diversity that you're going to get, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then, so you're looking at it that way. Then you're looking at, I think so much lately about the focus on what you've published,
mm-hmm,
and where you've published,
mm-hmm,
and how that completely erases the extra work that graduate students of color are doing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always, but can affect their productivity in grad school.
Well, sure.
Right?
I mean, not to mention the trauma level of living through brutal killing after brutal killing.
Well,
I
how mean, just, I, okay, there's
just
that,
trying but, to live in America, basically.
Right, but also let's just talk about making it through the classroom. I mean, mm-hmm, how many people did we have write for our Black Lives Matters posts over the last month who've written, mm-hmm, about the exhaustion and, mm-hmm, the trauma and the tension of being in the classroom,
right,
of saying,
course,
you know, where do I decide to engage?
Right.
How do
Which
I decide to engage?
Which battle am I
going to
fight? And when my
do?
Professor decides it's going to be Funny Name Day and then talk about all of the Black names in,
right,
the school she used,
right,
to teach at.
Right.
And am I going to take issue with this? Am I not? Am I going to be the only Black person? I am the only Black person in this classroom. What's going to happen? You know, every single thing is contested and fraught.
Right. And I think we need to really start to look at what that means. But I also want to add that the number of PhDs we see who belong to groups that are underrepresented, who are doing work with those groups during their PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing support things. They're,
yes,
making, they're building cohorts.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of creating all these amazing support networks and resources,
mm-hmm,
but that takes time.
Yes.
So the activism, I mean, it's defined as activism, which I find problematic,
right,
on its face.
Right.
Because it, but I saw just recently someone talking about, there's a Black woman talking about, nobody's talking about the 25th hour of the day that Black women scholars devote to each other,
mm-hmm,
to make sure their work moves forward.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening in the PhD that you're doing, mm-hmm, that in that collective effort, that then means that you have one article when,
mm-hmm,
you finish instead of two.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So as long as we continue to have this, I'm going to judge you by the,
mm-hmm,
how many and the level.
Yeah, for sure.
Then we're on our face screwed.
Or I'm thinking of the Black Lives Matter guest host that we had recently that was talking about a Black woman wrote that she didn't know, because nobody had actually come out and told her that the expectation was that you published in graduate school, and that what, and about, you know, 4 years into, you know, into her program and not too much left to do, pretty getting close to the end, she had a conversation with a white male grad student, and he said, yeah, I have three articles. And she said, you have what?
Right.
And he said, yeah, I have three articles out.
Right.
And she had none.
Right.
And she was like, wait a minute. And so somehow, and there's all there. I mean, there are so many different interlocking reasons, intersectional reasons why Black scholars, Black women scholars in particular, scholars of color in general, don't get the same kind of mentorship.
May not, yeah.
oftentimes in grad school, and then are judged for not having gotten it.
Right. So if you're going to review this massive pile, and you talk about it, you talk about it all the time.
Yeah, the need to
200,
reject.
The 200 people, you need a reason to reject. You're going to use your criteria as how much they've published and where. You're going to do that right away. Then you're going to do the stuff that I worry about, which is the deciding in advance whether somebody's going to be okay there or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I have heard this. I've heard it in so many searches of saying, I'm not sure she'll stay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he'll be happy here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. It's like, when did you get to be the parent figure of a toddler and to say, I'm not sure this school is right for little Jimmy? It's like, that's a grown ass human being who knows they are applying to a predominantly white institution. Guess what? They've been doing this a long time. So really, search committee, check yourself. Really check where you're saying, I'm not sure.
I mean, to be fair, when we had those conversations constantly.
Right.
Because neither school, Oregon nor Illinois, was optimal in every possible respect. Right. Oregon, Oregon's a beautiful place to live, and a lot of people do want to live there, but it's pretty marginal geographically and not a high status school. Illinois was a higher status school, but it was in Champaign-Urbana. People weren't thrilled to live there. So both schools had a problem with retention in cases. And so our conversation was always more about if they had a super, super fancy pedigree and a super high productivity level. This conversation was less about if they were a person of color and more about, they're gonna be here for a year and then get hired at some Ivy League.
Right, but I'm not talking about the conversations that are had. I'm talking about you're sitting there with your 200 stack and everybody on the committee has to go through it.
I thought you were talking about the conversations. You're talking about the stuff that's going through your head as you're going through the 200 applications.
You're saying, not this.
I hear you.
And I also think that those conversations are probably being had and people aren't saying the race thing, but they're all having the coded conversations
For sure. Yeah, of course.
We've both heard them.
Yes.
So, you know, I have heard them. The conversations that you're not supposed to ask, or do you think, or does anybody know him? Do you know, want to check out and see whether you think he'd be happy here?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why? Mm-hmm. What is the reason you think he might not be happy?
Mm-hmm.
So I just
who's not going to be happy in this equation? Is it really going to be him?
Is it going to be him? Do you think he doesn't know what he's getting into?
Yeah.
So,
yes, I hear you and I completely agree.
Right.
And then I also am just going to go back to what I said before, which is I think that white dominated or white in their entirety search committees are going to be more comfortable at the written application level. And then when the person shows up and they are a person of color, then that's when all hell breaks loose.
Well, and here's what I'm going to say about that. I'm going to say if they show up, this is where the whole we want diversity just is a flat out lie. Mm. And falls on its face and
flat
crashes
out
in. That is so you invite this diverse group to campus.
Yep.
You say, oh, this is so exciting. We have a Black applicant. We're so excited because we really want to diversify our faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And that Black applicant arrives and is unapologetically Black.
Right.
You know, just like, yes, this is what I do. This is how I do it. This is the way I operate in the world. This is the way I take up space.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it happen with Black people. I've seen it happen with Indigenous people. I've seen it happen with queer white people. I've seen it happen. Mm-hmm. Come in and just be unapologetically how you define yourself to be. Mm-hmm. And then it's a lot less fun.
Yeah.
This grand idea.
Because then all the milquetoast, the vanilla white people just get scared. They get scared and they actually, there is a name for it. And I think it might be race panic. Is it race panic? Is that the term?
I don't know.
But it's just like, this kind of a delusion or not, it's not delusion. What's the word? Anyway, it's kind of a panic trigger thing that suddenly you're just like, oh my God, I'm talking to a Black person. Ah, and say like preposterous things.
Yeah, and I was thinking,
I would not have I absolutely knew that it happened, but I did not realize the scale. I did not.
Oh, no, I know.
Until I, A, started running the Professors Inn and started hearing stories from our readers and clients.
Yes.
And then B, started reading the hashtag Black and the Ivory. Mm. And C, getting all of the guest posts, the many, many guest posts that we now have hosted on the Professors Inn. And those have opened my eyes
right.
to the things that people will say.
Right.
My God.
I always, at this point, we probably need to stop saying, my God, and just go, because it still has a little bit like, can you believe this? Good grief, Kel. This is terrible. It's we're probably at the point we need to go, fucking what's wrong with us, white people? What's wrong with us?
You're right. You're right.
So I agree.
I don't think that it's wrong. I don't think that it's wrong to when you are shocked and disgusted.
Yeah.
That it's as a white person by your fellow white people, I think it's okay to say that.
Yeah.
But I hear what you're saying too.
This is just me. Mm-hmm. But if I'm on Twitter and I see somebody say,
oh my goodness, I can't believe this is still happening.
Yeah. I mean, like I saw somebody on Twitter the other day say something about, you know, this thing occurred. And I thought, oh, there's going to be a whole lot of that's terrible. And I thought, if I was that person, I mean, I don't know their experience, but if it was about something related to my life that I knew and right. I've known every right. damn day of the week.
Like the homophobia.
Right. If somebody said, oh my gosh.
You deserve better.
Well, I'm just talking about the, oh no, it was actually you. Huh.
God. Set me up.
Sorry. Chanda.
Oh, yeah.
She wrote that she found out that two of her faculty members were openly white supremacists. And you wrote, oh, my God.
I did. I did write, oh, my God. And, you know, I did write, oh, my God. And you know what? I sat with that for quite a while. I did. I wrote it. I erased it. I wrote other things. I erased those. I said, you know, what do I want to say? And I said, you know, that's what I want to say.
Right.
That's bad. And
right.
I don't want to take up a bunch of space with my opinion. I just want to have a reaction.
Right. And I think it's really interesting. First of all, we could pull that all the way apart. I just wanted to have a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted you to know my reaction. Mm-hmm. So we could probably get schooled three ways from Sunday about that. But what I'm interested about that is like that we at some point we have to stop. We've really digressed, but what at some point that like, oh my God, I can't believe people said this to you. Oh my God, I can't believe you were on campus and this happened to you. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. But instead, this is the shit that happens, people.
Right.
So let's stop everybody waving their hands saying, oh, I can't believe they said that. And instead say, this is the shit that happens
right.
that makes you have, and
that makes you have a, you know, only one article.
Right. But also why your faculty is so white, why people leave after 3 years right. or 5 years.
Yes.
Why do they keep leaving?
Yes.
Because you keep refusing to allow actual
right.
diversity. People or acting what, like their whole selves.
What Aisha Ahmad, our guest poster, who is now a tenured professor. She just got tenure.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. In political science, she wrote what she called, it's in the Chronicle, a survival guide for Black, Indigenous, and other women of color. I might not have that title perfectly, but in any case, in the Academy.
Right.
And she wrote what she called the Great Gaslighting.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main gist.
Mm-hmm.
She said, congratulations, you've gotten in, and now you must confront the Great Gaslighting.
Right.
And it's basically like, we said we wanted you, but guess what? We really don't. We don't really want you. You're disruptive. And the more you are who you are,
right.
the more you do what we claimed we wanted, the more we're going to hate you and undermine you and then lie that we're doing it.
Right.
And say we're not. And just basically make life impossible for you.
Well, it's like that when they do all the diversity and inclusion, diversity, equity, inclusion hires, and then get mad at people when they start pointing out all the issues. It's like, we didn't hire you
right.
to point out that we have a problem. We hired you to
have a brown face.
And to look like we solved the problem.
Right.
We don't need to talk about the problem because right. we solved the problem.
Because we hired you and now the problem is solved.
Right. So that sort of not and we've seen it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again in the last couple months since the uprisings began, of people saying, you say you want us, but you do nothing to support us. Mm-hmm. You do nothing mm-hmm. to recognize the different experiences we bring, the mm-hmm. the different pressures that exist for us. You right. don't look, you know, you just have another,
right.
you know,
or what
anti-bias training.
Right. Or what I also call the challenge that that many types of minoritized scholarship presents to the epistemological foundations of the disciplines right. themselves.
Right.
I mean, if you took an anti-racist critique seriously in anthropology, the entire curriculum of anthropology would crumble and have to be, and the departments might have to just be shuttered. Or if you were going to keep them, you would have to completely revolutionize all the teaching from the ground up. Right. And nobody wants that.
Right.
Nobody's willing to do it.
Right. Well, I think there are people willing to do it. I think they're being kept out of the academy.
Yeah. Right.
Let's just be
right,
clear.
Right, right.
Well, there are people who are standing
nobody,
at
I
the
meant,
door.
Yeah.
Ready.
I meant the white power brokers right, and right. and everybody else.
So then we get to the last section because we're running really long. And I think that this.
So the campus visit takes place. Did we talk about that?
Well, I was just talking about when people arrive, then suddenly they're.
And our friend was at a camp, a black friend was a historian, was at a campus visit, and two senior white scholars were on the other side of the round table at dinner, you know, probably like seven people at dinner, very common campus visit dinner, discussing the, quote, pros and cons of slavery, unquote.
Well, I mean, yes, it's gross. Okay. And I just think, like, we've gotten stories from people who visit campus, you know, black women, black men who visit campuses, and the search is run so badly and they're treated so badly and left to wait or not explained or, you know, oh, sorry, we forgot to pick you up and or whatever it
or
is.
Or openly racist comments that then are sort of brushed under, swept under the carpet.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the fact that you know,
you mean incompetence?
Yes, but how that's read if you are the one and only black candidate who's being brought in.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
How do you, you know,
right.
step up your fucking game?
Right.
Like be on your game to
right.
say we are aware. We are aware
the
that this
are,
is the
are
stakes
higher
are higher
with you. They are
you,
higher with you.
And we're going to show you we get it.
Because if we forget to pick you up at the airport.
Right.
It's really going to look like something.
Yeah.
And, the
and
fact
it really
that
is something because you didn't stop and think this matters.
Right. And the fact that we forget to pick up every third person at the airport, which is, you know, highly likely to be true.
Right.
That just doesn't fly. That right. just doesn't fly. The stakes are different.
A few years ago, we got an email from a black woman who had an interview on a campus. And I remember this so clearly, talking about how over and over again she had been disrespected with things like that, not picking it up at the airport, but like not coming back and getting her for something, mm-hmm. leaving her in a room for an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. And she left at the end of the first day.
Oh, said, I remember that.
I'm out.
Yes.
I'm out.
Right.
And I thought, you know, and you're going to get read as blah, blah, blah. And
right.
they
angry
fucked
black woman.
Up.
Right.
So anyway, the campus visit, I think, is fraught for a bunch of reasons. There's the stupid, openly racist stuff. There's the you're not taking care
right.
of your people across the board. And that matters more in this situation.
Yes.
There's the you showed up in all your selfness, your whole selfness.
And that was too scary.
And that was too much
panic.
For all of us.
Yes. And then there was, and then there's the, those undermining statements that I hear about so constantly. You only got invited here because you're black.
Oh my God. Well, you should be really successful because this should be great for you. Oh, no problem for you because you're black. It's like, really? Right.
Well, you know, you're going to get tenure because you're black.
Right.
I mean, everything is utterly undermining, utterly saying you don't belong. You are not qualified. And I mean, it's.
And you didn't really do all the stuff I did to get mm-hmm. here. I mean, I've heard that my whole academic career. I heard it. I heard it at every level from the minute I went to college to the minute I left the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody saying, oh, that person got here because of this. Or, oh, yeah, that some little
oh, wait.
Thing.
You don't mean about yourself.
No.
You
no.
mean about other people. Because I was
people.
Like, why in the world would you have heard that?
No, no,
so
no.
I
mean, I've
you,
heard it
you,
around
you were,
me.
You were in the
I
white.
I was in the room.
You were in the room.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I have been in
right.
the room of so-and-so's here. Oh, well, she'll get an A. Oh, well, she'll
yep,
get that
me
thing.
Too.
Or she'll get that.
Me too. I hear it constantly as the professor is in, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, constantly.
White men say it all the time.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to get that job because
I'm not a Black woman.
And then we hear from all the other people who say, I was the most qualified.
Right.
This mediocre white dude got the job. That's what
that's
we hear.
That's what we hear.
Hell of a lot
that's
more.
What we see.
That's what we see.
We hear one thing.
We see
another.
Else, right.
Yeah. And okay, then a decision is made. And then that
based
is
on
all
that
of these
shit.
Things. And then the decision might be where, well, she just didn't quite fit. Yeah.
Yeah. The fit thing. They weren't quite doing what we want. And that's where we see those searches where suddenly what they say in the ad that they wanted, they hire something entirely different where there's a whole ton of reasons, they're all fed by everything we've just talked about.
Just to add one additional complicating factor, there are times when the department does seek to hire the candidate of color, and then it gets bumped up to the dean because the dean has to approve all hires. And deans take different. Some are very interventionist. Some are very hands-off. And I've heard stories where deans were like, no, nope, not that one. Don't want her.
Yep.
Don't want him. And then insists on hiring the white guy.
Right.
I honestly have rarely heard stories where it worked the other way, at the dean's level.
And then I wonder about this, and, you know, I don't know. I think about this and the culture in a department, and I'm thinking about the department I belong to, and there was a hire going on, and there was a Black person in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
Who was clearly top qualified candidate. And they went up to the provost to get and got that person hired as a target of opportunity hire.
Yes.
And then hired for the position.
Right.
So they ended up getting two positions.
Yes.
But they didn't diversify. They didn't hire. I mean, it's like they did this extra hire.
Uh-huh.
And the extra hire gets seen as this, you got hired because you were.
Yes.
So still not, you're from the beginning coded as not part of the department because you were an extra hire.
And yet the target of opportunity hires were created just exactly for that reason.
Right.
In some ways.
Right. But I always, what I watched is the vibe about top hires is like, it was they're sort of these extracurricular, not really part of us.
You didn't go through the full peer review or the full, you know.
Right.
I
think for liberal people on campus, it was like, oh, great. We managed to get, you know, they got five top hires. That's fantastic. Now we have this. But I never heard them talked about it took years before they weren't a target of opportunity hire. They were just part of the department.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another place where I think it all creeps in.
It does.
And so
creep
I don't think
in.
It's
it
a bad, I'm not saying in. I think that's a bad hire.
Right.
I think, what does that say when we say, okay, we're going to get that white guy and we're going to get you.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I hear exactly what you're saying.
Which I'd love to see is we're going to hire this Black woman and we're going to hire that Black woman, that Black man, right?
Right. Right.
I'm going to hire this Indigenous woman and I'm going to hire that Indigenous man. I mean, something where we're saying, instead of like, oh, now we can get the... Mm-hmm. Anyway. All right. Well, we've made it through the five pages in 50 minutes.
Yeah,
so we've got
a
whopping 10 minutes per section or whatever digression. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Love to hear your feedback about this because there's a lot more that we're planning as we move through the book. And
there's undoubtedly stuff that we're missing.
Of
so
course,
we really,
of course there's
really,
stuff we're
really
missing.
Want this to be a conversation. Yeah. Karen's working on a second edition. You have told us for years what works for you. You've told us what doesn't work for you. So I really, really hope that you take the time to email us or talk to us on Facebook or Twitter or what other places you find us.
Or in the premium.
Oh, yeah, site. Absolutely.
That's a really good place to do it.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.